There were two types of men, cops and robbers, and Addison, well, the chief hated to say it, but he was a robber. The kind who stole a man's money and his property. Greg had been a robber, too, the kind who stole a woman's heart. The chief was a cop, through and through, but that didn't mean he would prevail. Going head-to-head with Addison, he almost certainly would not. "Want a popper?" the chief asked, secretly wishing Addison would end up with a sore, dry spot on his tongue like the chief now had.
"God, no," Addison said.
And they both chuckled. Jeffrey said, "Sorry I'm late." He had not left Delilah at home at night since Greg and Tess had died, he said, because he was worried about her. Crackerjack Delilah, the bat out of hell, Joan Jett meets Julia Child, a woman formidable in a dozen different ways, and she was a mess now. "I can only stay for one beer," Jeffrey said. Jeffrey was a cop also, the chief thought. He was a cop's cop, incorruptible. "I'm sorry to hear about Delilah," the chief said. "I miss her cooking."
"I miss her cooking too," Jeffrey said.
"Have a burger," the chief said, nodding at his own plate, half demolished. "I can't stay that long," Jeffrey said. "The man was a Supreme Court justice."
"Right," the chief said.
He had to put aside his feeding trough. The extra horseradish in his coleslaw had his mouth buzzing in a way that made him want to shovel in more and more food and deal with the unpleasant business of the evening. Or he could just forget about it. He had a choice here. He could open up the Pandora's box that was the tox report, or he could let it go. He cleared his throat. "I asked you both here for a reason." Pause. Jeffrey and Addison leaned forward over the mafia table. The waitress again looked afraid to approach, but she had the extra mayonnaise for the chief's burger, and she wanted to get Jeffrey's drink order. "Stella Draft, okay." She fled. The chief said, "The ME ran a toxicology report on the bodies. They had both been drinking. And Tess was high on something." The chief paused. "The opiate most commonly found in heroin."
"Heroin?" Jeffrey said.
"Did either of you know about Greg or Tess mixed up with heroin? Or any other kind of street drug?"
"No," Addison said.
"Well, Greg smoked weed. We all knew that. And he did cocaine back in his Velociraptor days." The chief looked at Addison and remembered his Ferragamo loafers iced with mud. A $300 pair of shoes had gone into the hotel trash without a second thought. The bill for the abandoned canoe had come in at a whopping $4,200, and Addison had paid it. The chief had always felt crummy about that, but Addison had the money, and he'd convinced the chief that it had been his idea to orphan the canoe. That was the robber in him. He'd saved the chief $2,000, but stolen his dignity. The chief also remembered Addison toking up with Deep Purple and scrawny sideburns, and how envious he'd felt. The Lost in the Woods story with Addison was the chief's best story, but right this second the chief didn't find it amusing at all. 5 phone calls to Tess on the day she died. Addison was hiding something.
"I just thought you both should know," the chief said. "The accident can't be taken at face value. Something else was going on."
"Well," Jeffrey said. Pause. The waitress dropped off his Stella.
"Anything else I can get you?" she asked.
"No," they all said at once. She scooted away.
"Well, what?" the chief said. Something was coming.
The chief had heard hundreds of people bear witness, leak secrets, confess. The human need to spill the beans, to tell, could not be underestimated. Even Jeffrey, the judge, had this urge. He was about to share privileged information. But what the chief had learned over the years was that his thirst to find out led him to be burdened with information he would have been better off not knowing.
"When I spoke to April Peck at the funeral," Jeffrey said, "she told me she'd been with Greg the night before he died."
Suddenly the chief felt full.
He pushed his plate away. He exhaled, burped beer and horseradish, felt nauseous.
April Peck.
Yes, he thought. Beautiful women were dangerous. But beautiful girls were even more dangerous because they weren't seasoned. They didn't know that beauty was a weapon, and so they flung it around carelessly. April Peck had been after Greg. She had been hunting him on the night of October 23rd. Of this, the chief was convinced. He believed that April had gone into Greg's classroom on purpose, wearing a wet T-shirt without a bra. He believed that she had only been pretending to be upset. She needed an excuse for physical contact. The chief believed that she had forced herself on Greg. The part the chief had a harder time with was Greg's response to that. Had he resisted from the get-go? Or had he succumbed to what would have been as irresistible as a bowl full of juicy berries with whipped cream on top? Had he accidentally grazed a nipple? Had his skin heated up when April put her mouth on his neck? Had he responded for even just a second? Of course he had. In his 17 years as police chief, Ed Kapanash had pressed the boundaries of his authority only once. That was on October 27th, when he met clandestinely with school superintendent Dr. Richard Flanders at the station. The chief and Flanders had gone over the details of both Greg's account of what happened and April's account. They came up with the following conclusion. April probably did initiate. Greg probably did, in some way, respond. What man wouldn't respond to April Peck? Both men agreed it would take someone very strong, the Pope, for example. The important thing was that Greg had not capitulated. He had not crossed the line. He had not slept with the girl. Flanders said he would continue with the inquiry. He had to, for protocol's sake. But he assured the chief that unless any new information was revealed, Greg would keep his job. Flanders shook the chief's hand, looked him in the eye. They were men. They understood each other, and they believed they understood Greg. The chief was able to go home to Andrea and say he'd taken care of the problem. But Greg had the temperament of a spoiled child. His whole life he had gotten whatever he wanted. He had gotten a taste of April Peck. It was not surprising to learn that he'd wanted more. Greg was a robber. There were two incidents that the chief had chosen to overlook. The first was this. On the night of February 2nd, a domestic disturbance call had come into the station. It was a mother-daughter situation. The mother had stolen the daughter's car keys in order to keep her at home. The daughter was threatening to stab the mother. She had pulled a kitchen knife. The mother called the police. A squad car was sent to 999 Pulpus Road, where they found Donna and April Peck in a messy catfight, hair pulling, face scratching, a strap ripped on an expensive camisole top, April's. There was a knife on the counter, a 5-inch serrated sandwich knife, but no one had been cut or stabbed. There was screaming and name-calling, even after Walker and Dixon, the officers, separated the two women. Walker was a 10-year veteran, a deer hunter and early morning fisherman. He lived alone and had neither the time nor the patience for hysterical women, even though April was, in his words, one of the hottest chicks I have ever laid eyes on. Dixon, on the other hand, was the chief's secret weapon. Dixon was too smart to be a policeman. The chief had him marked for a detective in the near future. Dixon had an incredible memory. So he recalled for the chief later, word for word, what the women had said.
She put me under house arrest. I'm 18 years old. She's going to see him.
Him who, ma'am?
The teacher. I am not.
Don't lie to me, April. I've checked your phone.
You don't know what you're talking about. The cancer has gone to your brain. How dare you, young lady?
Dixon had it all written down in his report. They had concluded that as April was 18, she was free to leave the premises. The car in question was registered in April's name. It was hers. She could use it. Do you have a safe place to go? Dixon asked her.
Yes,
she said. And the mother had said, "She's going to meet the teacher." Dixon had tried to hold the chief's gaze after reporting this last bit, but the chief would have none of it. Hearsay. Who knew what teacher she was talking about, or if it even was a teacher? It could have been Casey, the phys ed teacher, who had his own issues with April Peck. The chief didn't want to speculate, and he didn't want Dixon speculating. But deep down, he knew. Of course he knew. And he thought, "Jesus, Greg." And he thought about calling Greg up or surprising him at the begonia and saying, "What the fuck are you doing?" But the chief backed away from that particular ledge because it was hearsay, and the anguish of the first accusation had just healed, and who was the chief to pull the scab off? On the night of April 18th, it was Dixon again, out cruising the tough Nantucket streets alone. It was the first night of spring break. Many islanders were away on vacation. It was 2:30 in the morning, and Dixon came across two vehicles parked at the end of Hummock Pond Road, facing Cisco Beach. He pulled up, because there was no good reason for two cars to be parked at the beach in the middle of the night. Dixon was hoping for a drug deal, something he could really bust. It had been a dull winter. He touched his gun, though he'd been told in training that he had no prayer of ever using it. As Dixon was remembering this, there was movement. A figure moving from one car to the other. The car on the left, a silver 4Runner, plates Q22DR9, backed up, turned around, and tore out of there in what Dixon would call a classic getaway. He climbed out of his car and poked his flashlight into the dark window of the other car. And there she was, April Peck. She looked at him. He indicated that she should roll down the window. She did, but only a crack. He said, "What are you doing out here in the middle of the night, Miss Peck?" And she said, "Looking at the ocean. Is that a crime?" The plates had been Greg's. Dixon took this information to the chief in the morning. The chief said, "Well, the girl is right. There was no crime in her sitting there. Were you thinking of issuing a parking violation?" Dixon said, "I just thought you should know." Dixon walked out, and the chief was left breathless. He picked up the phone, then dropped it. Greg and Tess had taken the kids to the Children's Museum in Boston. They had wanted to do Disney for spring break, but because of the roof replacement, there wasn't enough money. They would go next year, they said. The chief vowed that when Greg got back, he would talk to him. He would say, "If you don't stop this, I will tell Tess. I will tell Flanders. You will lose your wife, your kids, and your job." He would say, "Stop this now. It isn't worth it." But the chief had not spoken up, and it was a source of private shame. By the time Greg and Tess had gotten back from Boston, the incident seemed diminished. The urgency had passed. The chief chose to believe that Dixon was bored and trying to drum up scandal. "April Peck," the chief said. The name itself conjured a vision of all that a good man was meant to avoid, but could not. Jeffrey nodded. Addison said, "It's clear what happened." His neck was growing red from the collar up. He looked like he was going to boil, but his mopiness had disappeared, which made the chief glad. If there was heroin in Tessa's blood, then Greg drugged her. He drugged her and dumped her off the boat. "No," the chief said. "No," Jeffrey said. "No," Addison said. He jumped up and bumped the table. "How can you possibly believe otherwise? Isn't it obvious? Greg was trying to get rid of her so he could be with April." "Hey now," the chief said, "respect." Addison sat back down and put his head in his hands. 5 phone calls to Tess on the fateful morning. Had something been going on between Tess and Addison? Impossible. But Addison was a robber. Then there was Greg and April Peck. The chief had lifted a rock and found bugs. Why was he surprised? Addison said, "He killed her." "He died too. It went awry." Was this possible? The chief was losing his grip. April Peck, the tox report, Andrea crumbling at home. Andy had eaten too much. Jeffrey stood up. I have to get back home. The man was Jesus Christ. Addison said, You think I'm right, don't you, Jeffrey? I mean, you're the one who just said he was still seeing April. Jeffrey grimaced. I can't say what happened on that boat, Ad, and neither can you. The important thing here is the kids. Those kids have to believe it was an accident. But we don't have to believe that, do we? Addison asked. The chief said, I've got the bill. Addison said, No one's with me? I'm sorry I brought it up, the chief said. And he was. Me too, Jeffrey said. Truth be told, I just don't have the focus for a murder mystery here. Addison stared at them both balefully. He said, I'm leaving too. They all shook hands. Did the chief need to remind them not to talk about this? So for the kids' sake, Addison held up his palms. Jeffrey said, Not a word, obviously. Addison and Jeffrey weaved their way between the tables and out of the restaurant. Faith trailed them and kissed them both before they left. The waitress reappeared and cleared their glasses and the chief's plate. She said, Can I interest you in dessert? The chief said, Yes, and he ordered the mud pie. Andrea. The only time she felt like a human being was when she was up in the farm office with Jeffrey. It felt secret, illicit, affair-like, even though they never got close enough to each other to touch. But there was warmth, a connection, energy. They were on a mission to remember everything they could about Tess DeRosa McAvoy. They had made it all the way to modern times. Tess and Greg were married, they were teaching, taking modest vacations, fixing up their house. They were getting ready for the next step. It's time, Andrea said, to talk about the pregnancies. Jeffrey paused. He looked squeamish. He didn't want to go there. He was a typical man. He couldn't do trimesters or blood, separated placenta or gushing miscarriage. It was feminine territory, like tampons and waxing. He wanted to skip it. He wanted, perhaps, to say, It was a tough road, but eventually Chloe and Finn were born. Well, too bad. He had taken Andrea places during these conversations that she hadn't wanted to go. There were hours, for example, when they had to talk about Greg. So, yes, they were going to do the pregnancies. They couldn't talk about Tess without talking about her pregnancies. Tess got pregnant for the first time in January of 2000. She and Greg conceived, most likely, in the high-gloss luxury of room 1910 in Caesar's Palace, Las Vegas. They had only just started trying to get pregnant, and voila, pink stick. Tess jumped for joy. She had been put on Earth to be a mother, she felt. She embraced her pregnancy. She talked about her sore breasts, her incessant nausea, her cravings, grilled cheese sandwiches, tomato soup, her complete and total exhaustion. She fell asleep with her head on her desk while her class was at music. In week 8, she announced to everyone, including the school custodian, that she was pregnant. There was no reason not to shout it from the mountaintops, pregnant, due September 30th, because Tess's life had been easy and blessed. She was secure and smug. She had been put on Earth to be a mother. The call came at 4 in the morning. Andrea picked it up thinking that it was a call for Ed, a police emergency, something bad happening to some poor nameless, faceless soul. But it was Greg. It was dark and still and silent at 4 in the morning at the Kappenash house, but on Blueberry Lane, where Greg and Tess lived, all the lights were on and Greg was shouting. She's bleeding, Andrea. She's really fucking bleeding. There is blood everywhere. Andrea's heart fell through a hole and disappeared. Tess was losing the baby. She crossed herself and said to Greg, I'll be right there. I've called 911. An ambulance is coming. Okay, I'll meet you at the hospital. She hung up. Ed rolled over and said, What's happening? She's miscarrying, Andrea said. Shit, he said. Ed and Andrea had two healthy kids asleep upstairs, ages 7 and 5 and a half. They had been parents long enough to know how nature worked. 1 out of every 5 pregnancies terminated spontaneously in the first trimester. This didn't mean the woman wasn't healthy or couldn't go on to have 6 future children, all of them perfect and beautiful and headed to Ivy League colleges. It just meant that this one particular pregnancy wasn't meant to be. Andrea tried this reasoning as she sat by Tess's bedside in the hospital. The ultrasound showed that the miscarriage had been complete and clean. There was no need for a D&C.
"That's good news," Andrea said.
Tess, who was lying in bed looking pale and despondent, said,
"Good news? How can you say that?"
She asked the question but did not wait for Andrea's reply. She burst into tears that became full-blown hysteria, sobbing and moaning about the lost life, the destroyed dream. Tess's vision of herself as a mother had popped like a soap bubble. Tess's tears were the most heartbreaking display of sorrow Andrea had ever seen, and she cried in sympathy and apologized again and again because her words had been insensitive. Insensitive, but true. The pregnancy wasn't meant to be. There was no reason. These things just happened. It wasn't Tess's fault. It wasn't anybody's fault. Tess got pregnant again 2 months later. She told only Andrea and the chief. She was going to keep it a secret until she had her ultrasound at 17 weeks. She did not talk about her nausea or her exhaustion or her leaden breasts. She wore smock tops over her swelling midsection. She looked positively morose and at times frightened, as though there were a man with a gun in her house, holding her hostage. She and Greg heard the baby's heartbeat at each of their prenatal appointments, but Tess would not crack a smile. She would not relax. She said to Andrea, "I am not going to let myself love this baby until he or she is born." Andrea said, "Honey, everything is going to be fine." And in fact, at the 17-week ultrasound, everything did look fine. Wonderful, even. The baby was a week ahead in its development. It was a little boy. Everyone breathed a sigh of relief. Tess was able to tell everybody, "It's a little boy, due the week before Christmas." By then it was summer. School was out. Tess was feeling magnificent and happy, healthy and hungry. She power-walked in the mornings, then ate scrambled eggs and a bran muffin with homemade peach jam. She would pack herself a lunch of tuna with pickles and a juicy plum, and she would ride her bike to the beach, where she let her swollen belly absorb a moderate amount of sunshine before she carved a wide, shallow hole in the sand and turned over. She was 21 weeks and 4 days along when she fell off her bike. Nothing happened. There was no oncoming car filled with hooting teenagers, no clap of lightning to startle her. She simply lost her balance, wobbled, and fell, just as she had years earlier when she broke her arm. She fell with a thud onto her side, crushing her swollen belly. She would later say that she knew instantly her baby was dead. There was blood everywhere, and pain that made her knuckles turn white as she clenched her hands into fists and screamed without making a sound. Oncoming bikers called 911, the ambulance came. Tess was put on a jet and flown to Boston, and yes, the news was bad. The baby was dead, but it could have been worse. Tess could have died, too, from the hemorrhage. When Tess gained consciousness, this time in a bigger, whiter, more sophisticated hospital, the chief and Andrea were there, and Delilah and Jeffrey and Phoebe and Addison. They stood in a semicircle around the foot of the bed, and Father Dominic, the priest from St. Mary's, was there. Greg was there too, looking baffled and helpless. He didn't know what to do. In the minutes before Tess came to, Greg had sung "Puff the Magic Dragon" softly, almost to himself. The song was a lullaby of sorts, meant to comfort, but it was a song of loss too. By the last verse, they were all singing along, even the chief, even Father Dominic. Tess opened her eyes. She had perhaps caught the tail end of their singing and didn't understand it as a tribute. She ordered everyone out of the room except for Father Dominic.
"What about me?" Greg said.
sounding like a jilted boyfriend.
Go,
she screamed. There was no consoling Tess this time. She was carrying sorrow and guilt. She had lost her balance and fallen off her bike. She had killed her son. She should never have been riding a bike. It was a lapse in judgment. She had been thinking of herself, the pleasures of a summer day, and not the baby. Her baby was dead. It was her fault. She would not hear otherwise. There was a small graveside funeral, at which Tess and Greg buried a coffin the size of a shoebox. It was all too sad and too nebulous for anyone to handle. It was the loss of a life none of them had known, and yet this somehow made it worse. Or rather, what was worse was watching a part of their beloved Tess die, the part that was peppy and chipper, the part that was loving and kind and nurturing. She was sad now, unable to think or talk about anything but her loss. She was as crumpled and useless as wet tissue. She saw a therapist. She went to a pregnancy loss group where, she told Andrea, her story was by far the most gruesome. She quit attending the pregnancy loss group first, then she quit her therapist. Dr. Amlin keeps trying to tell me it was an accident, Tess said. If I hear the word accident one more time, I'm going to cut my ears off. Andrea squandered her life savings, taking Tess to Canyon Ranch in the Berkshires. Tess half-heartedly submitted to massages and facials, while Andrea swam hundreds of laps in the pool. They ate poached salmon and lightly dressed greens in the dining room. When Andrea tried to start a conversation, Tess would shake her head. I don't want to talk. As she and Andrea lay between 600 thread count sheets in their beds, she said, I'm not cut out for the whole maternal thing. Andrea said, like hell you're not. Andrea was spending damn near $1,000 a day and getting nowhere. On the final morning, she dragged Tess out for a sunrise hike to the top of what they would later refer to as the godforsaken mountain. All the swimming and weights and yoga and fresh fruit had worked on Andrea. She felt clean, light, and empowered. She basically dragged Tess up the damp, mossy trail, booby-trapped with tree roots and hidden rocks. They did not speak. The hike was too strenuous to spare the breath. It was still dark. They were making their way using a flashlight provided by the hotel. By the time they were a steep 100 yards from the peak, Andrea could spy the yellow banner flying from the pole that marked the top. Tess was bawling. She couldn't get to the top, and if she did, she was going to be so depleted of resources that she would only have the energy to throw herself off the mountain into the abyss. Andrea kept going. Tess followed like a dog Andrea was dragging on a leash. They reached the peak, and they watched the color of the sky warm and lighten. It was a moment from a commercial or a tearjerker chick flick. It was the moment when everything was supposed to change. They would stand side by side with their arms flung around each other, their faces bathed in the buttery light of a new day, and it would be an epiphany. Tess would be cured. The realization would hit. It was time to move on. Instead, Tess found that her legs were unable to support her, and she collapsed on a rock. She was howling like a trapped animal. Andrea thought, I have seriously fucked up. I made her hike up here, but she has no prayer of making it down. I am going to have to carry her. And though Andrea would have said that she would be willing to carry Tess anywhere, she could not realistically get Tess down the mountain. Andrea had to call the front desk at Canyon Ranch and have them send a rescue team. Andrea had had a speech written in her head, words she had planned to deliver at the summit. Something like this. The baby is dead. It was not your fault. You have to deal with it like the reasonable, strong woman you are. You have to put the pieces back together and move forward. The delivery was supposed to be no nonsense and tough. But Andrea couldn't say the words to Tess in her current whimpering state. So they sat next to each other on the rock, waiting for nearly 90 minutes until two strapping men showed up with a stretcher on which they carried Tess down the mountain. The only thing Tess and Andrea talked about while they waited for the rescue team was what they would order for breakfast once they made it back to the dining room. Andrea was addicted to the Canyon Ranch granola, almonds, dried cherries, amber nuggets of dried apricots, with house-made yogurt. Tess said she wanted 4 poached eggs with salt and pepper, which in itself felt like a victory. In November, Tess got pregnant again and miscarried the day after she found out. She said to Andrea, "I can't do this anymore. I'm going back to using my diaphragm." Andrea said, "Okay." Jeffrey jumped in here. He had been sitting quietly on his milk crate, but when Andrea reached this point, he sprang to life. Because wasn't it the painful truth that in the harrowing aftermath of Tess's second lost pregnancy, Delilah had gotten pregnant with Drew? The farmer and his wife were pregnant. It was happy news, except for the fact that they were intimate friends with a couple who had lost 2, then 3 consecutive pregnancies. Delilah could not bring herself to tell Tess she was pregnant, and because she didn't want Tess to find out from a third party, she didn't tell anyone else, not even Phoebe. Jeffrey was angry about this. It was unfair that he and his wife could not celebrate their pregnancy because of Tess and Greg's difficulties. Jeffrey said, "Greg and Tess are going to understand. They're going to be happy for us." Delilah said, "If you believe that, then you do not understand anything about human nature. She's going to hate me. I'm going to lose one of my best friends." Jeffrey and Delilah told Phoebe and Addison first, at a private dinner at 56 Union. Or rather, Phoebe guessed, because Delilah had ordered a club soda instead of her beloved espresso martini. Phoebe and Addison were happy for Jeffrey and Delilah. Phoebe had just watched her brother Reed and his wife go through the whole childbirth thing. She now had a nephew and was enjoying being an auntie. And now Delilah. Phoebe couldn't wait. She hoped Delilah had a girl. She wanted to buy tutus and glow-in-the-dark nail polish. Jeffrey and Delilah drove home from that dinner feeling good about the pregnancy. Of course Greg and Tess would offer their blessing. Delilah picked up the phone as soon as she got home. It was 10:30 on a Saturday night, but Delilah didn't care. The dread of telling Tess about the pregnancy was eating away at her. The anxiety had to be bad for the baby. Delilah was getting it over with now. Greg picked up the phone. Delilah said, "Greg, I'm pregnant." There was silence. Delilah said, "Would you put Tess on the phone, please?" Greg said, "No, no, no. I'll tell her myself." Delilah said, "I'll tell her. Put her on." There was silence, a shuffling sound. Then Tess came on the phone, sounding very young and half asleep. "Hello? Tess, it's Delilah." "Hi."
"Hi."
Delilah swallowed.
"Listen, I'm pregnant."
Silence.
Then Tess said, "I bet it wasn't easy for you to tell me that."
And Delilah burst into tears. Drew was born by cesarean section after 18 hours of labor. He weighed 10 pounds. Delilah was exhausted and in extreme pain. They put her on a morphine drip. She was the only person in the maternity ward, so Jeffrey left her and baby Drew in the capable hands of the labor and delivery nurses and went to the begonia to meet Tess and Greg, the chief and Andrea, and Addison and Phoebe. They had all been at the begonia since the news of Drew's birth had reached them 4 hours earlier. They were in a festive mood, raising their glasses to toast Jeffrey as he walked in. Greg got up to play a set and started with Danny's song, dedicated to Andrew Jeffrey Drake, Nantucket's newest native son. Jeffrey was attentive to Tess. He was concerned about her, but she looked great. She looked happy. She kissed Jeffrey full on the lips. He tasted the sweet tang of the champagne she was drinking. That night, Tess got so drunk that she, famously, forgot to put in her diaphragm. 9 months later, the twins were born. Andrea sighed. She was teary. She was always teary during her time in the farm attic with Jeffrey, because it was like reliving secret stolen time with Tess. But this story made her teary for a different reason. This was the greatest story ever told. The story of a woman who deserved something good, who hung in there and persevered and got something miraculous. Not one healthy baby, but 2. A boy and a girl, a perfect matched set. Andrea could remember holding Finn in his bunting at the hospital, and Tess was glowing like the Virgin Mary. Never mind that the conception had been less than immaculate, including, as it had, 6 glasses of Moët Chandon. Tess asked Andrea at that moment if she would be Finn's godmother, and Andrea said, "Oh my God, I would be so honored," as if she hadn't been expecting it. Tess said, "I'd like to thank you for not lecturing me when we were stuck on top of that godforsaken mountain at Canyon Ranch. I don't think I could have handled it." Andrea said, "I had my speech all prepared." Tess said, "I did okay without the speech. I finally did okay." Andrea said, "You did better than okay, honey. These children are beautiful." Tess said, "So I just have one other question." "Shoot." "Will you be Chloe's godmother?" "Oh my God," Andrea said as she sank onto the side of the bed next to Tess. Because this she had not been expecting. This was an embarrassment of riches. 2 darling babies to guide spiritually, the way she had been guided by her mother's sister Catherine, the way Tess had been guided by her aunt Agrippina. They were, Andrea felt at that moment, all going to be okay. "I would be so honored." Jeffrey. He was going to give them one shining moment together before things fell apart. And really, it should be his wife telling this. She was better at it than he was. She remembered every last detail about each one of their group trips, down to what they ordered for dinner, who sat next to whom on the airplane, and what the bar bill was at the end of the night. But Delilah wasn't available, and this story needed to be told, even purely as an antidote to the sad and difficult material that came before and to what was yet to come. South Beach, Miami. There had been so many great things about this trip, but perhaps the greatest thing was that it was spontaneous, pulled together in 5 days. It had been the most brutal winter of all time. Brutal. The temperatures were in double-digit minus figures for a week straight. The harbor was frozen, and the Coast Guard had to send an ice cutter through so the steamship could make it back with fuel and food. Even so, the Stop and Shop was poorly stocked and the butcher was closed. The Begonia was open, technically, though only half the menu was available. And one night they ran out of draft beer completely and there was nearly a riot. It was that awful second week of February when the realization hit. There was no more football. Nothing to do on Sundays but eat too much, drink too much, read the paper, and play Scrabble, which was what the 8 of them did. Barney and Drew were 4 and 2, and the twins were 3, and all of them had perpetual head colds and runny noses, which were impossible to beat. You kept them home, you gave them Campbell's chicken soup with stars, and let them watch unlimited episodes of Caillou and Miss Spider. They got better. Then you put them back into the petri dish that was preschool, and they got sick again. The situation was wearing on everyone. Around their harvest table, Jeffrey saw his wife and their 6 dearest friends looking pudgy, pale, listless, and crabby. They each had a section of the Times, dealt out like poker hands. It was very much the luck of the draw, except that Phoebe always got Sunday Styles. And on that particular, awful, football-less, slate-gray, 10-below-0 day, Jeffrey had the travel section. He was halfway through his 3rd Kahlua coffee, to which he had uncharacteristically added a shot of whiskey, and the cover photo, a bunch of half-naked people drinking mango mojitos in South Beach, seemed to mock him. "That is where we should be," he thought. Then he thought, "That is where we should be." He excused himself from the table. The Scrabble game was growing predictable anyway, with Addison trying to get away with the word QAT once again. He claimed it was Russian for hat, and since he was the linguistic expert among them, no one bothered to contest it. though today Delilah was in a combative mood and said, "No foreign words."
"What?"
Addison said. "You can't make that rule now." Delilah said, "I should have made it 7 years ago." Jeffrey slipped over to the computer in the corner of the kitchen, taking his Kahlua whiskey coffee and the travel section with him. He proceeded cautiously. He read the fine print. He clicked on every link. South Beach. This was, he realized, simply a reinvented, reimagined version of the Miami Beach his parents and grandparents had visited a generation before. Except now it was Cuban food and nightclubs with monosyllabic names like The Drink and B.E.D. Now it was cocktails made with freshly squeezed fruit and vegetable juices and Art Deco hotels with rooms draped in white Egyptian cotton. One might not think that South Beach was a farmer's kind of place, but it was 87 degrees in South Beach and sunny. Jeffrey was going to make this happen. 90 minutes later, with breaks to refill his coffee and change the DVD for the kids, with 7 answers over to the table of, "I'm working on something here, give me a minute," he had reserved 8 tickets on American Airlines, Boston to Miami, for $237 per person. And he had, on hold, the penthouse suite at the Sagamore Hotel, which was locked in like a Lego between the Art Deco gems of the National and the Lowe's. The penthouse slept 8 and cost $1,050 per night. It was less per person than the Radisson in Hyannis in the height of summer. The last piece of the puzzle was babysitting. The Capenashes always used Mrs. Parks, the retired dispatcher, and for the other kids, Jeffrey emailed the Bulgarian twins, Lana and Veselina, who had worked at the farm market the summer before and who had unwisely decided to stay on Nantucket for the winter, to see what it was like. Did it rival a former communist bloc country in the gray and dismal department? How about 24 hours with no bread at the supermarket? Jeffrey and the Bulgarian twins joked about how bad the winter was, how boring, how cold. Would they want to make an extra $500 babysitting? Their response came back. "We want to go to South Beach, too." "Only kidding. Yes, to babysit." Jeffrey stood up from the computer with all the details written down on a sheet from Delilah's to-do pad. He turned down the music and cleared his throat. The 5 Kahlua whiskey coffees made him feel light and giddy and unlike his usual self. He, the parsimonious farmer, had single-handedly booked a trip to South Beach, Miami. If he wanted to go, he knew they would want to go. He was right. They jumped for joy. They let go a group cheer. They toasted one another, and they toasted him. Imagine, Jeffrey leaving Friday. They vowed to buy Lana and Veselina and Mrs. Parks truly fabulous thank you gifts. Addison said he had a friend who owned a sushi restaurant right there on Lincoln Road. Greg had played in a band with a guy who was now the DJ at the underground club at the Delano. Woo-hoo! It was the best vacation they'd ever taken, and they hadn't even left yet. Phoebe went to the tanning booth twice the week before their flight and burned the skin off her nose, but no matter. Tess didn't have a single bikini that fit. The scale at the gym said she had gained 7 pounds since the summer. But who cared? It snowed again on Wednesday, and again school was canceled, and again Jeffrey and Delilah were trapped in the house with 2 rambunctious little boys who wanted nothing more to do with Delilah's homemade Play-Doh and other indoor distractions. Delilah said, "I'm going to miss them so much, but not really." She made 6 dozen chocolate chip cookies and 3 dozen peanut butter cookies with chocolate kisses. "Mommy and Daddy are going to be gone for 7 days." They arrived at the airport in full-length down coats. Phoebe wore her fur hat with the ear flaps, which the chief jokingly called her Russian QAT. Their flight to Boston was canceled because of weather in Boston, even though on Nantucket it was bright and sunny, with a wind chill factor of minus 22. Addison worked his magic with the woman behind the Cape Air desk, and they were on the next flight to Providence and had been rerouted from Providence to Miami. Piece of cake. 1 stop at Au Bon Pain, an issue of The Economist front to back, and a 20-minute nap later, Jeffrey's plan had come to fruition. They stepped off the plane in Miami, Florida. They shed their coats, gloves, scarves, and the Russian QAT and followed the man holding the sign that said, "The Castaways," to the limo. Is it possible to tell a story that is happy from start to finish? Doesn't the word story mean that there is conflict, then resolution? Maybe the trip to South Beach didn't properly qualify as a story, because all Jeffrey remembered was good upon good, best upon better. They asked the limo driver to stop at the liquor store on the way to the hotel. They bought champagne, Patron, Mount Gay, white wine, a case of Corona, tonic, seltzer, Coke, limes, lemons, bottled water, pretzels, peanuts, sesame sticks, potato chips, nacho chips, bottled salsa, bubblegum, and a scratch card. The scratch card was a winner, the chief announced. $500. Everyone thought he was kidding. Each of them bought scratch cards from time to time, and no one had ever won more than $2. I'm serious, he said. Delilah checked and let out a hoot. $500! They couldn't believe it. It was, at that moment, better than world peace. The chief cashed the card, collected the money, and paid the bill. He had enough money left over to pay the limo driver and tip the bellman at the hotel who was responsible for their 16 bags. The Sagamore was cool and white and filled with avant-garde objets d'art. The concierge was a lean French woman named Genevieve, who had platinum blonde hair and a geometric cut. Upon their arrival, she handed out lasciviously pink raspberry caipirinhas, along with ripe pieces of mango dipped in sea salt. Genevieve led them through a secret passageway to a space-age elevator that jetted them up to the penthouse suite. The penthouse suite was all white, as promised, with mirrors and sleek, cutting-edge electronics. There were four identical white bedrooms lined up to overlook the ocean. Each bedroom was dominated by a king bed iced with buttercream and dotted with fondant pillows. The bathrooms were white tile and white marble threaded with gold. There was a living area with white leather sofas and high-design glass tables. There was a kitchen, which consisted of a fridge to store the liquor and a counter on which to cut the lime wedges and spill the snacks. Addison did both things in short order. The place was heaven. Not just heavenly, but heaven, as in the place Jeffrey wanted to go to when he died. Always when he checked into a hotel, his first instinct was to make love to his wife, and he had that instinct right now. He led Delilah wordlessly into their white bathroom, peeled off her winter clothes, and began to kiss her. "Do you love it here?" he asked. But she was too happy to answer. Later, he lounged on the green and white striped canvas furniture on the impressive penthouse balcony, drinking a Corona, inhaling the view across the white beach and the ocean as if it were a drug. He did not remember every hour of the vacation as clearly as those first hours, but he did remember certain things. Sprawling with Delilah on the white-cushioned papasan by the shimmering turquoise pool, debating the pros and cons of going to war with Iraq with Addison, who lay next to a sleeping Phoebe in the neighboring chaise. All the women, and the men, around the pool were beautiful. They were thin and tanned and wore designer sunglasses and sleek bathing suits and white, flowing cover-ups. They spoke French or Portuguese. They kissed on both cheeks. They ordered the huge salade niçoise for lunch and ate only the olives. They ordered cold, sweating bottles of white wine and drank them the way Jeffrey and the others drank water, which came in cylindrical glass bottles that cost $12 apiece. It was hot in South Beach, 87, 89, 94. Delilah was Mediterranean. She turned brown as a nut in one afternoon, but Jeffrey was a farmer. He respected the sun. He knew what it could do. He dunked frequently in the pool. He drank four bottles of the expensive Dutch water. He moved under the umbrella to play dice with Greg and the chief. They always tried to fit in wherever they went, to respect the sense of place. In Vegas, they had gambled and driven to see the Hoover Dam. In London, it was Buckingham Palace and the Crown Jewels. At the point in Saranac Lake, they canoed and hiked and cooked over a fire. In South Beach, it was clear from the beginning they did not blend. They were as obvious as a pack of grizzly bears, the unhealthy pallor, the flab, the red Sox hats to shield their eyes from the sun. Andrea, in her black tank suit, did actual laps in the swimming pool, and their fabulous European fellow guests watched her with undisguised interest, as though she were some kind of curious wildlife. A woman doing the butterfly stroke in the pool. The ladies went shopping on Lincoln Road. They were in and out of BCBG, Ralph Lauren, Lilly Pulitzer, AG, Lucky Jeans, and a bunch of boutiques that sold sequin dresses and over-the-knee white snakeskin boots. All the women bought new sunglasses at Aspen Optical, even Andrea, who couldn't have told you whether Tom Ford was a fashion designer or a car salesman, even Tess, who couldn't afford them. The new sunglasses were big and round, with gold bling decorating the sides. The women put on their new sunglasses and mugged for the chief's camera. "We're getting there," Delilah said. They had to change their internal clocks. They drank triple espressos in the morning, skipped breakfast, took a nap by the pool, drank iced tea and expensive Dutch water, picked at a light lunch. Did they even serve carbohydrates in South Beach? Walked on the beach, shopped frivolously, savored a café con leche at the Cuban place on the corner, called the kids to check in, then the day began. They opened Coronas and slipped in wedges of lime. The girls popped champagne and filled up slender flutes. They toasted one another. They took deep, grateful drinks. They showered and lounged on the impressive balcony while wearing the hotel's waffled robes. They snacked on sesame sticks and sliced mango with sea salt. It was 7:30. The sun was setting. They made love discreetly behind closed doors while getting dressed. Greg played Buffett and James Taylor's Mexico, and then, once the sun set, he swung into Sinatra and Bobby Darin, and they all gathered in their silken sequins, heels and perfume, ready to leave for dinner. Their reservation was at 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock. At home, they would have eaten pot roast at 5:30, been finished and cleaned up by 6, had the kids in bed with stories by 6:30, and been back down with the dishwasher churning at 7, while outside snow piled up or the wind screamed like a woman in agony. Some nights they watched reruns of The Sopranos. Some nights they rented movies. Some nights they crawled into bed at 7:30 with the latest David McCullough tome and fell asleep after 10 pages. Some nights they cleaved to each other and made love despite being weighed down by the layers of flannel, chenille, and goose down. Every night, save for the ones when they gathered at the Begonia, they were fast asleep by 9 o'clock. But not in South Beach. In South Beach, they arrived at the threshold of the restaurant at 9 o'clock and were escorted to their table, where they sat, without deviation, in this order: Phoebe, Addison, Tess, Greg, Delilah, Jeffrey, Andrea, the chief. They were a strand of DNA, repeated, then repeated again. They ate things like sushi and soft-shell crabs in a Meyer lemon reduction, and they shared desserts with passion fruit foam and honeycombed pineapple. They drank wine at dinner and ended with shots of Sambuca or sips of tequila. And then, feeling happy, happy, happy and ready to go, they cabbed it to a nightclub. At the first nightclub, BED, the doorman had their names on a list provided by Genevieve, and they were whisked past the waiting mob, made up mostly of teenagers, Jeffrey noticed. Truly, to fit in South Beach, they needed to be 20 years younger. They were shown to an alcove with two cocktail tables pushed together and 4 ultra suede cubes where they could sit, should they want to sit. They looked out over the dance floor at more gorgeous Europeans lounging on round beds in the midst of a sea of gyrating young bodies. Jeffrey ordered a bottle of champagne and a bottle of Grey Goose and tonic and lemons. A beer for the chief, $20, and 4 bottles of Icelandic water. They came with a dish of salted cashews, presumably complimentary, delivered by their preternaturally beautiful, though scowling, cocktail waitress. She poured everyone a drink with disdain. She knew their type. Married 30 and 40-somethings, probably with a stable of kids back home wherever they lived, Peoria or East Bumblefuck, Idaho. Jeffrey took a sip of his ice-cold vodka tonic with a twist and declared it an elixir of youth. He was ready to dance.
They let loose in a wild, free, sexual way. Jeffrey had never moved his body like this in public. There had been some crazy parties at Cornell, of course, but this was elemental, tribal. It was a trip to the moon. Jeffrey was released. Was he 38? The father of two small boys? The owner of 162 acres of permafrosted land? It didn't matter. He took off his jacket, slid off his tie, unbuttoned his shirt. He was sweating. He was breathless. He was dancing. He was living. And he was not alone. There, like satellite planets coming in and out of his orbit, were Greg, Phoebe, Delilah, the chief, Tess, and a guy Jeffrey didn't recognize, an interloper who was getting awfully close to Phoebe. Jeffrey was aware of this much, and he was about to ask the guy to step back. Phoebe could not be counted upon to protect her own airspace. She seemed not even to notice this guy. Then Jeffrey realized the interloper was Addison, without his glasses. He had taken his glasses off. He was sweating too profusely. They would slip off. The dancing was so wild. They would fall off. The reason the interloper kept bumping into people was because it was Addison, the sight impaired. He could not see a damn thing without his glasses. And Jeffrey wondered what it felt like to be dancing in a blur of bodies, to be reliant on sound, smell, touch. Jeffrey wanted to be Addison. Just then a cry went up, and Jeffrey was nudged in the ribs. He turned. It was the chief, pointing. Across the dance floor, there was an elevated stage with two poles. There were two women dancing, three women, four women. "Look at the girls," the chief shouted. The girls, the women, Delilah, Phoebe, Tess, and Andrea, were all up on stage, spinning around poles, lifting their legs, throwing their heads back. Phoebe was the most beautiful of the four women, and the best dressed, in a short go-go number of red and orange fringe. But she was the weakest dancer. Spaced out, she was a cross between a deadhead and bad Twyla Tharp. Tess was adorable and gidgety in her white pants and navy-striped nautical top. She had been born to do the twist. These two used their good judgment and hopped down from the stage into the arms of the strapping black bouncers. This left Delilah and Andrea. Jeffrey and everyone else on the dance floor was mesmerized. They danced separately with their poles in a surprisingly erotic way. Okay, Delilah had watched a lot of Sopranos episodes this winter, but where had Andrea learned to pole dance? Then they came together in a sensual, crowd-pleasing moment, and Jeffrey felt aroused, then disturbed. The only two women he'd ever made love to, well, it was powerful to see them together like that. They kissed once, briefly but passionately, and Jeffrey's heart stopped, went into free fall, then started again, pounding in sync with the bass. The chief whistled, then pounded Jeffrey on the back. "Look at our girls!" The chief's tone of voice said it all. This was enough fantasy to last him the rest of his life. As for Jeffrey, well, what was he to think? How to process this? The only two women he had ever loved had kissed each other. Jeffrey's past and his present and his future. He wasn't sure what was going on inside him. Addison said, "What just happened?" He couldn't see. He'd missed it. Jeffrey kept dancing. He spun around. He put his hands in the air. Those were his women. This was his entourage. They either fit in or stuck out. He was either not himself or more himself than he'd ever been before. He was hot and more than hot. He was warm, finally warm. This had been his idea. His idea. He was in heaven. They all were.
Addison, are you going to tell him? Are you going to tell him you love me? I'm afraid. I'm afraid you won't get it. The $9.2 million deal closed without a hitch, and Wheeler Realty received a check for $368,000, half of which went into Addison's pocket. Normally, this would have been cause for celebration, corporate and personal, but Addison was distracted. What to do with Tess's cell phone? He had flat out lied to the chief. Addison was by no means an honest person,
He was a real estate agent, after all, prone to stretching the truth, and he had for 6 months concealed his affair with Tess. But something about looking Ed Kapanesh in the eye and flat-out lying about Tess's phone instilled fear and shame. Should Addison come clean? Tell Ed that, yes, he had the phone? Show Ed the text messages? Tess was afraid. Of the water? Of Greg? Of something more nebulous? There was no way to figure out what had happened on the boat. The chief had one idea. Addison had another. Should Addison confess to the affair? What would that help? It would help nothing, he decided. It would only hurt. Addison tucked Tess's iPhone in the top drawer of his desk, which locked with a key. Addison had one key, and Floribel had a spare key swimming in the ashtray where she kept paperclips, rubber bands, and safety pins. The chief would never find Tess's phone in Addison's top drawer, though it was the obvious first place to look. Should Addison move it? Take it home or put it in his car? The skin on the phone was traffic light yellow, bright as an alarm, impossible to miss. Would Phoebe find it? He pulled the two pieces of the felt heart from his pocket. He was not only emotionally feeble, but mentally feeble as well. He believed that this heart had power, that it meant something. As he handled it, it ripped again. The heart was disintegrating. Was this a sign? Addison could not accept it as a sign. Floribel loomed over his desk. She eyed the torn, misshapen pieces of heart on his desk. What is that? She sounded disgusted, as if they were pieces of pig heart. Nothing, he said. You need to pull yourself together, dealer, Floribel said. As ever, the woman was speaking the brutal truth. She slapped a whopper of a check down on his desk, covering the scraps of felt. There's some money. Go get yourself a shrink. Delilah. Thoughts of escape occupied her at all times, the way some people, she supposed, fantasized about sex with Robert Downey Jr., or winning the lottery and buying a power yacht, or being selected for American Idol. Freedom had always been Delilah's drug of choice, and now, who could blame her? Tess and Greg were dead, everything was painful, even breathing hurt. Delilah dreamed about living alone in the south of France, riding a funny European bicycle down a path cut between fields of lavender toward a charming village where she would buy a baguette and runny camembert and a bottle of wine that would aid her quest to block out everything that came before, her life on Nantucket, her friends, her husband, her children. She used to love a crowd. She used to demand the company of others. But now she wanted only to be alone. And even that wasn't quite true. She couldn't stand herself. She wanted to unzip her body and step out of it. She wanted to be attached to a machine that would erase her memory, obliterate her guilt, wipe her clean. She had run away once before, in high school. There had been no reason for it other than boredom, a standard-issue teenage restlessness, and a desire to see what other possibilities the world contained. Delilah had had a pleasant childhood, and a less pleasant but still okay adolescence, growing up in South Haven, on the shores of Lake Michigan. Delilah's father, Nico Ashby, was a real estate developer, responsible for the burgeoning suburban sprawl in the acreage just off the lake. He brought South Haven Taco Bell, Blockbuster, I Can't Believe It's Yogurt, Lucky Nail Salon, Subway, Stride Right Shoes, and Mailboxes, etc. He also had his hand in the bigger, uglier, more egregious development along Route 31 towards St. Joe's, the Walmart with its attendant Big Boy Diner, the Staples, the 18-theater Cineplex, the Applebee's, the Borders. Nico Ashby and his wife and two daughters lived in a stunning Victorian house on the bluff that overlooked the town harbor and the South Haven Yacht Club, where Nico had been president for 9 years. Nico was a local hero, a successful businessman, a philanthropist, a member of Rotary and the Lions Club, a model husband and father, a big, good-looking guy with a full head of dark hair, a bronze tan in 3 seasons, and a booming laugh. Nico Ashby. Everyone knew him. Everyone liked him. Delilah's mother, Connie Ashby, née Albertson, was short, dark-haired, trim, pretty, and obsessed with the following things. Her person, exercising, hair, skin, nails, and clothes. Her daughters, bake sales, Girl Scouts, summer camp, decorating for school dances, and her husband. She met Nico at Michigan State. He was a starting linebacker. She was a cheerleader, petite enough to serve as the top of the human pyramid, the cherry on the ice cream sundae. And yes, these people really got married. They were beautiful and blessed. They were successful. They had gorgeous, healthy daughters. Delilah was loved and encouraged. She was brilliant in school, a fact that made her parents proud. But Delilah's precocity also allowed her the time and leeway to goof off. Delilah, as a teenager, was not beautiful. Her hair was too wild and curly. She wore braces for years. She had huge breasts and the rear end to counterbalance it. She was voluptuous, her mother said. But Connie Ashby weighed 90 pounds soaking wet, as did Delilah's sister, Caitlin, and it was clear that having a voluptuous daughter perplexed her. Boys did not love Delilah, but they liked her. Her best friends were all boys, the best-looking boys in her class, the athletes, the dope smokers, the clowns. They liked her whip-smart sense of humor, her sense of freedom. Delilah Ashby was not afraid of anyone. She ran away in early May, when the periphery of the lake was blooming with dogwoods and azaleas. The Ashby family had just gotten back from a week in Fort Lauderdale, where Delilah had looked upon the university students on spring break with envy. Freedom. She dreamed of a highway with no one on it, a deserted stretch of beach, an endless ribbon of blue sea, a grid of city blocks where no one knew her name and no one expected her to show up for lacrosse practice or memorize theorems or sit down to dinner at 6 and contribute to the conversation. Delilah itched. She could not sleep. The house was suffocating her. School and the kids in it, even Dean Markbury, whom she loved with the ferocity of a lion, were slowly killing her with their predictable sameness. She had to get out. She needed money. She had saved $700 from babysitting, and over the course of 4 days, she stole. She stole from her father's wallet, from her mother's stash for tipping the manicurist, from petty cash in the kitchen drawer where the family grabbed $5 or $10 for the offering basket at church. She stockpiled $1,000. She estimated it would last her 3 weeks. She left in the middle of the night on her bike. In her backpack was the money, 2 bottles of water, an extra pair of jeans, a bra, 5 pairs of underwear, 3 tissue-thin t-shirts, her lacrosse workout clothes, sunglasses, flip-flops, and a box of Pop-Tarts. It was all she could ever imagine needing. She had left a note on the kitchen table in the spot where members of her family normally left notes for one another. She had given the note careful thought. It said, "See ya." Delilah wanted her parents to know that, A, she had not been abducted, but rather was walking away from this nice life of her own volition, and B, she was not leaving in anger, but rather in the spirit of self-discovery. "See ya" would also, hopefully, keep her mother from completely losing her mind, implying as it did that mother and daughter would set eyes on each other again. Delilah, although self-centered and self-absorbed, realized that what she was doing would destroy her parents, as well as 13-year-old Caitlin, who worshipped her. Delilah had peeked in on Caitlin before she left. Caitlin was breathing heavily through her orthodontic headgear. The sight of her and the knowledge of Caitlin's deep impending sorrow almost kept Delilah from going. But Delilah was infected with a desire to be free, and once she was biking along the Blue Star Highway, her spirit soared. She was headed to Saugatuck, where she would catch a bus to Grand Rapids, and in Grand Rapids, she would catch the bus to New York, where she would catch the Chinatown bus to Boston, and in Boston, she would take the Plymouth and Brockton line to Hyannis. From Hyannis, she would ride the ferry to Nantucket Island, a destination she had discovered in the pages of National Geographic, which she read in the high school library while she was supposed to be researching a paper on Blaise Pascal. She stumbled across the article about Nantucket by accident,
but she was captivated by the way it looked, all quaint and historic and New England-y. It looked like home. And God, what a feeling when the bus pulled out of the depot, when the driver punched her ticket and said, "In Grand Rapids, head to Bay 9, bus to New York City." The sensation of miles of asphalt putting time and distance between Delilah and the life that held her down titillated her. She wasn't running from anything. She wasn't running toward anything. She was just running for running's sake, and it was a drug. The blurred landscape out the window was a soothing poultice for her itch. Go, go, go! She transferred buses in Grand Rapids, peed in the terminal, bought some peanut butter crackers because somewhere in her head was her mother's voice nagging her about protein. She had both seats to herself practically the whole way to New York. She stretched out and used her backpack as a pillow. She read 17 of the complete stories of John Cheever, which had been assigned in her English class. She noted, with a certain satisfaction, the difference between reading a book because it was assigned and reading a book because she wanted to. Which led to her next quasi-intellectual thought, which concerned Henry David Thoreau and his desire to live deliberately. And that, Delilah decided, was why she had hopped on this bus. She was going to Nantucket Island because she wanted to live deliberately. She wanted to choose her path every second of her existence. She wanted to cultivate a heightened awareness. She was in charge of her well-being. She was her own person. Forget the edicts of home and school, the din of the hallways, and the obligation she felt when Dean Markbury handed her a joint. She had to take a toke to be socially acceptable. She was free of that now. Sing it. Free. The bus stopped just before crossing the George Washington Bridge. Delilah had had a seatmate since they stopped in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. A brown-skinned man of indeterminate ethnicity. Salvadoran? Thai? Lebanese? The man was about 50 and stunningly handsome. He had bulging arms. He wore a tight black t-shirt and jeans. He wore a diamond stud in his left ear and a pair of Ray-Ban Wayfarers. He had nice, feathery black hair, and he wore what looked to be an expensive watch. But what was riveting about this man was that he held a pack of cigarettes in his hand the entire time he was on the bus. He opened the pack, inspected the filter ends, counted them perhaps, shut the pack. Opened the pack, pulled a cigarette halfway out, dreamed about lighting up right there on the bus. The inhale, the burn, the satisfaction, the high, the addiction met. Delilah was fascinated with watching his struggle. The want, the can't have. The need, denied, minute after minute. It was almost sexual, watching this handsome, tough-seeming man, older perhaps than her father, want it, want it, want it. It was transferable. Delilah wanted a cigarette, too, and she wanted this man. The boys Delilah had known at school had wanted only one thing, to touch her breasts, to ogle them bare. Would this man also want that? Did he notice her breasts? She breathed deeply, squared her shoulders, tried to edge her breasts into his field of vision. He wanted only the cigarettes. The bus stopped. The mighty bridge loomed in the windshield. The man stood up, collected his backpack. Delilah was heartbroken. No, he could not leave. Was this even his stop? Or was he getting off the bus solely so he could smoke? She wanted to follow him. Who was he? What was his name? Where did he live? What country was he from? Where was he going? What had he been doing in Williamsport, Pennsylvania? Home of the Little League World Series, the sign said. There were 1,000 stories contained within this man. 1,000 stories in Delilah herself and everyone else on this bus, not to mention the 1,000 stories of the 8 million residents of the city on the other side of the bridge. Delilah watched this man's back. She would never see him again, of this she was sure. And then she eyed the cherry-red cover of the Cheever. It was a grain of sand. The stories that made up the world were infinite, like the stars. New York to Boston, Boston to Hyannis. Out the window, Delilah saw the ocean. On the ferry to Nantucket, she scanned the local paper and found several ads for rooms to rent.
She craved a small space of her own, a hole in the wall, a hiding place like Anne Frank's where the Nazis wouldn't find her. She was very far away from home, and yet she felt exposed and obvious, as though she had a camera trained on her. She disembarked from the ferry. There were people waiting on the dock, but none of the people was waiting for her. She was a 16-year-old girl who had traveled 1,200 miles to get here, to Nantucket Island, her newly discovered spiritual home. The best thing about Nantucket was that it fulfilled its promises. It looked exactly as it did in the magazine. If anything, the air was more rarefied than Delilah expected. It was fresh and filled with salt spray, evergreen scent, and fog. Delilah found a payphone on the wharf and started dialing numbers from the ads in the newspaper. The first place she called had already filled the room. The second place, ditto. The third place, ditto, and this worried Delilah, because everyone knew the third time was a charm. At the fourth number, no one answered. Delilah filled with a hot, prickly panic. This was an island. She had to find a place to stay. It wasn't like she could just move a town over. The fifth place had to work. There were only five ads. But the man who answered the telephone asked Delilah how old she was. She said 19. And then what she looked like. Delilah had heard all the requisite warnings about people who didn't have her best interest at heart. She hung up. It was 4:30 in the afternoon. She was dangerously close to screaming out, "What have I done?" Deep breath. She called the fourth place back, let the phone ring 15 times, and after the 16th time, someone answered. A little old lady. Yes, the room was still available. The room was free of charge. The woman, Tenny Gulliver, her name was, just wanted someone else in the house, someone to take out the trash, which she could no longer do, someone to be around in case the unthinkable happened. Delilah would be responsible for paying a quarter of the electric bill in addition to her phone charges. Okay? Okay, Delilah said. Tenny Gulliver gave Delilah directions. She could walk from the wharf. Delilah slung her bag over her shoulder and walked through Nantucket Town. The houses were dignified and old-fashioned. They had window boxes planted with geraniums and majestic front doors. There were lights coming on and cooking smells. Delilah crossed the cobblestones. She walked up brick sidewalks.